For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. If you have a itchy phone finger and you want to dial in tonight or this afternoon, by all means, you can dial in now, or you can dial in on our last segment because we have a interview for the second and third segment with Dr. Vile. We're going to be closing up on that interview that I did with him. While I'm talking about that, while you listen to these interviews that I have with these constitutional scholars, I want you to listen to them, you know, reproaching and admonishing me that I'm talking about things that are completely unconstitutional. Why do I say this? Because you won't hear them say that. You will not hear them say that what I'm saying is outside the boundaries of the Constitution or within the framework of what the framers had given us. That being said, they may not like what I'm talking about because it may take apart some cabals, or it may kind of ruin the gravy train, or upset the ore cart that they have coming in some cases. If, you know, there's lots of organizations that are really dependent on the, you know, the grants and money coming from the federal government. But not only that, and I've said this before, that the conservative entertainers and the grievance industry, the progressives and so forth, all everybody that's doing radio shows and TV shows that you tune into, that you watch, they're making bank. And they're making bank because there's a problem. They're not making bank because they're fixing the problem and they're going to make it go away, because absolutely, if you look at the solving of this problem in Republic Review and what I'm trying to do, I'm actually trying to create obsolete my career here. I'm trying to end my career. And so I'm hoping that I don't have to do this for the next 5, 10, 15 years. I don't want to become a really well-rounded radio personality and public figure. I really want to solve this problem. And it's not about trying to make millions of dollars to become the dominating conservative entertainer. I really don't care too much. I mean, I may be entertaining, and you may laugh at some of my jokes and something like that, but that's beside the point. That may be just a serendipitous point in time that we can enjoy. But bottom line, you will not hear these scholars talking ill about what I propose and so forth. But anyway, the Dr. Vile segment will be second and third, so you can call in now or in the final segment if you really want to call in. And again, all of these shows, if you listen to Dr. Vile today, some of the things we were extending from previous conversations and so forth. So you really do need to listen and download these podcasts so that you can hear the entire dialogue, start understanding what certain references to certain words and so forth that I use. So you can download these at ReclaimingTheRepublic.org on the Podlink button on the right-hand side of the page. For local announcements, tomorrow, September 21st, we will be celebrating the Constitution as a joint effort. In other words, the Republican Party, the Constitution Party, and the Libertarian Party will kind of be coming together. This is like one of our first efforts that we kind of collectively stepped in and said, we want to make this a success. Now, the Constitution Party kind of took point on this, and they started this a ways back. And as we started coming together, as I will just say, kind of a high-level committee of leadership, we are working together in trying to create focus on the Constitution so that we can center our civics, our government, our politics, our communities on the Constitution. You've probably been hearing me promoting these things. And so as we do this, I believe that's our road back. That's the way we take back our city. That's the way we take back our county. That's the way we take back our state. And that's the way we take back our republic. And so We're working together, and we hope you will join us tomorrow night at 7 p.m. It's free to the public. It will be at the Northeast Community Center, and that's at 4001 North Cook Street. And I will be putting this up on my podcast page tonight with this podcast, so you'll actually have this information on my podcast page as well. So by all means, that's at reclaimingtherepublic.org. Another local announcement, City Councilman Ed Pace will be hosting the following town hall events, and he does this every week. Every Wednesday, it's at McDonald's on University and Sprague at 9 a.m. And every Friday at 9 a.m., it's Forza Coffee on Sullivan and 4th. And every Saturday at 8 a.m. on Rosars, or at Rosars on University and Sprague. He's actually not up on the roof. Campaign fundraisers. There is going to be a campaign fundraiser, and that is coming up on the 28th of September, and it'll be at 6:30 in the evening at La Belle Vie, and that is in Spokane Valley. The information will also be on my podcast page as far as the address. It's on Apple Valley Way. This event is for the Spokane Valley City Council members that are running as far as the conservatives. And this is being sponsored by the Northwest Grassroots Organization. The MC will be Rob Chase. The keynote speaker will be Representative Jacqueline Maycumber. And so hopefully you can set aside some time, come down and be a part of this. I will, as soon as I find the link to your invites or what have you, because I want to say it's a barbecue or something like that. And I believe it's a no-host bar, but anyway, it'll be a fundraiser to help those who are supporting the Constitution. And those candidates that will be supported by this will be Caleb Collier, Mike Munch, and Ed Pace. So that being said, the Friday Republican Coffee Club this Friday will be Jake McCullough, and he is from the Institute on the Constitution, and he will actually be the keynote speaker tomorrow for the Constitutional Celebration at the North Community Center that I spoke of first. And as well, on the 29th, G.R. Mobley, myself, I will be presenting an encapsulated version of my executive summary. So a summary of my summary, because these are kind of short meetings. And so if you don't know where these are, this is on Hamilton and Trent. And the actual locations will be on my reclaimingtherepublic.org as well, since these are standing meetings and we've been announcing these every week for you. Again, after the break, I'm going to have Dr. Vial on. And then next week, we'll have Ward Connerly on. And we did a long interview with him. And then we will have a Bay Area radio show host, Bob Zadek. He's broadcast out of San Francisco. He also airs in Seattle and Sacramento. We sat down and kind of talked about his book. We talked about the framers. We talked about the problems with the Constitution. And we talked about Republic Review. And if you want to cut to the chase, he says he's my number one fan. So I don't know. Last time I could tell, it was my wife, my mom, and maybe he's my number three fan. Anyway, yesterday morning, I got up very early, and I was on a radio station in Philadelphia, and they had me on for an hour, and I kind of fire hosed them on Republic Review and gave them the concept of the authenticity, the authority, and the power that the states possess over the Constitution. And it's just, and I use that metaphor of King of Rohan in that trance by the soothsayer Wormtongue, believing he can't do anything. And then when Gandalf broke the spell, he became that, I wouldn't say young, but he became the vibrant king and a leader of Rohan and stood up and, you know, marshaled what he had left of his army because he dwindled it under that spell. But anyway, that's all we've got to do, folks. We've just got to wake these states up and say, do your job, minus the expletive that I, you know, was thinking there. Anyway, forgive me for thinking that. But that being said, they've invited me back after I went through this discussion with them on their radio show. They're inviting me back to be a participant in a round table with some of the constitutional experts that they have been using, because this is really new to them. And I've told you folks, once this idea gets out that the states actually have this audit authority and power, and again, there's nobody that can refute this constitutionally. The states actually have this. It's inherent in the contract, folks. That any contract that's out there, the principal holder of that contract can always step in and say, I never gave you this authority. I never gave this power. Where in the heck did you get this from? Now, the states may be complicit, but that's another story. When we come back after the Vial interview, I will be going through the Madison veto bonus bill, because I've been talking about this. So I'm going to read those excerpts out of the Madison bonus bill, and you're going to love it. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this and the next two segments. So thank you for staying tuned, and we'll be right back. Okay, so we are back for another segment, and I've actually held over Dr. John R. Vial from Middle Tennessee University from our previous three segments, because we've just been going down all of these discussions, rabbit holes, whatever you want to call them, tangents, and we're still trying to get, I think, the further light and knowledge and insights from the good professor on, you know, maybe the positive thing of drawing the line and saying you can't just continue to do this and drift and allow the electorate and popular opinion. You have to start abiding by this, or this thing has no weight anymore. So anyway, back to you, Doctor.
Okay. Traditionally, I think part of the problem we have is traditionally we've relied on the judiciary for, sort of holding the line. And, as we've discussed, and in the area of civil rights and civil liberties, certainly they have expanded, the oversight of the national government on the part of the 14th Amendment. They came very close when it came to Obamacare. If you remember, we've had, two or three major decisions, and each one of them has been a 5-4 majority. Very tenuous, and one, going so far as to split the difference between the taxing and spending clause and the commerce clause.
Right. Correct. And if we continue to rely on the judiciary, then we can continue to actually leave the door of judicial activism alive and well. And my assertion, or the whole reason I'm going down this, and the reason this is a life passion for me, is that I believe we've got to close that down, that the states have to say, no, there's nowhere in here that the Supreme Court was given the authority to amend the Constitution and make new things constitutional. They were limited to the jurisdiction of the Constitution, and they shouldn't be able to reach into issues such as marriage, such as abortion, and all of the health care, and all of these other things. Had they held that line, they would never have been able to, and I understand that they were threatened, and we had a tyrant that basically said, I'm going to stack the court, and I will overthrow you with all of my new appointments. And
and to some extent, both sides have bought into that. I mean, if you think of, what's the most consequential thing that's come out of the first 6 or 7 months of the Trump administration, it's been a judicial appointment. And with every expectation that, from one side, he's appointed to preserve the Constitution, but for many people, if that's different from existing interpretations, then they see that as a form of activism.
Correct. Well, so that goes into, this other line of thought that I have, is if you look at the establishment back in the day, even the Republicans and the Democrats have kind of have the same group think, because even Coolidge called himself a progressive. Teddy Roosevelt, I believe, you know, gets the honors of being the first progressive president. And so today we're looking at a completely changing landscape in politics because Trump got elected because of the anti-establishment. And it is interesting because here's the oxymoron. He is reaching into, you know, appointments of the bench that are probably establishment thinkers because they're not going to be the anti-establishment. Where are the anti-establishment judges? You know, somebody said, as a matter of fact, there's an author in Georgia, his name's Mark Urbach, and I've had him on the show before. And he said, you know, GR, you should be the next Supreme Court justice because...
Well, you better get a law degree first.
I understand that. And I know
I had a professor once. He's a great guy, great student of the judiciary, but has, like me, a PhD rather than the JD. And so somebody pointed out, one of his friends pointed out that you really, it's not required in the Constitution that you have a JD.
Right.
And he recommended my professor, Henry Abraham, as a possible appointee.
Uh-huh.
And then Henry wrote some things that were a little more conservative than this critic wanted, and so he took him off the list in his next edition.
Interesting. Yeah, so that is true. There are really no standards because back in the days of the Constitution, I think James Madison received an honorary JD, but a lot of the framers, I don't think, had JDs. And
well, a lot of them, Jefferson's a good example. He read law under George Wythe, and it's probably not a better legal education he could have gotten, but he did. To my knowledge, he didn't have a formal law degree.
No, but he passed the bar for Virginia,
right,
or whatever that standard was, because he did practice law in Virginia. And so I guess that's all you had to do back then. You didn't.
Patrick Henry earned his in about 6 weeks. by just sitting at, you know, going to a judge and convincing him that he knew enough to be an attorney. And he was good at it.
He was a very convincing man.
Yes, he was.
But he, along his way, he picked up a lot of friends and foes. But
yes, he did.
Back to, and here we go. I'm going to circle back around.
Get me out of the rat hole.
Yes,
again,
we have all of these judges that are still part of the groupthink. And we do have this big movement, and I think you would concede or maybe acquiesce, or maybe you'd say, well, maybe. Because of your argumentative skills, but I think that the anti-establishment is growing, and I think that the sentiments amongst a lot of the flyover states is moving in that direction, that we've got to get out of this, you know, this living constitution. We've got to get back to the hard, fast constitution and document.
And unfortunately, I think it's a little bit different. I think we're polarizing. We have groups on each side that are farther to the right or left than they previously had been, and it's very hard to get much compromise between them. I mean, when you get a Trump and you get a Hillary, or you know, you get a Bernie Sanders, I don't think you could get 34, 35 states right now to agree on much of anything.
And bottom line, you need 38. 38
yes, exactly.
to actually make a change, but I say
That's
you
right.
only need 13 states to stand up and say you can't do that anymore because you don't have 38 states to do that. This energy stuff, you've got to stop that. This education stuff, shut it down. This healthcare, all of these things that you're doing that are outside the Constitution, if I get 13 states, then now I've got that that constitutional barrier that says we never amended the Constitution to give you these powers, and we're going to take these back. We're shutting these down. And so,
well, again, you can make that kind of assertion, but I don't know how you would enforce it. I mean, I don't know a court that would recognize the power of a state to conduct such an audit, to enforce such an audit.
Well, the Article 7 clearly states that it requires state buy-in, not court buy-in, for the Constitution to be valid.
Well, for the ratification of the Constitution.
And further, further ratification of anything to be constitutional requires 38 states. But it's the Constitution is pretty clear
50, yes.
that it left everything, and all the founding documents are pretty clear. It left everything to the states to determine what is to be constitutional or not. And so I know that the court's going to sniff this as, you know, we've got this real threat here that the states could step up and actually, undo a lot of the stuff that we've kind of allowed happen. And I get that. And I think it's really important because the worst thing that can happen to me is they discard the Constitution because they say, you know what? And I think that's what maybe I'm going down that path to forcing people to either stand up for the Constitution or it's going to be gone, because the next political expediency, urgency, whatever, for political purposes, they will discard the Constitution because they've done it before. And you know this, Professor, that FDR nationalized almost everything. Even Nixon price controlled everything. So we're coming up on a break, and I will, if you could hold on for one more segment, we
sure.
can try to wrap this up. And maybe next time we'll do the 17th Amendment. All right, folks, please stay tuned. We will be right back with the Good Doctor. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Vile, for hanging on and being patient with me. I hope I'm a good student.
Absolutely.
So my biggest fear, and I think most people are recognizing this, that there's no stopping the overreach, and there's just no stopping. And it's happened historically that they've actually set aside the Constitution three times. I think the Civil War was one, where it was kind of set aside, habeas corpus and those types of things. And during the World War, actually, I think even World War I and then World War II. And then once again, they set aside the Constitution with Nixon in price controls. And so my real big concern is that this next big disaster, they're going to say, you know what? We've been doing so good as a government. We don't need this thing anymore. We're going to do what's best for everybody. Don't worry about it. And I don't want that to happen. And you say,
well, I don't either, obviously.
Okay.
And, that's one reason we have elections.
Yes.
I think the original hope, I do think a lot of us, I think we tend to vote on, what programs we like or dislike at the time, rather than, the Bill of Rights particularly, when Jefferson wrote to Madison, it wasn't in the original Constitution, and Jefferson hadn't been there, and he writes to Madison and basically says, every people are entitled to a Bill of Rights.
Right.
And, he was hoping they would be enforced in courts, but beyond that, he also thought that they would have an adjudicative function, and that people, would read the rights and say, well, by golly, I have to go back to an earlier illustration, I have the right to worship God as I please, and that should include the right to educate my children in the values that I uphold. And you've seen quite a bit of that, I think, in the homeschooling movement.
Yes.
Not always by conservative Christians either. I mean, you have groups all along the spectrum who think that the public schools have led to more conformity than is necessary, but also sometimes inadvertently or otherwise end up bringing forth values that are not necessarily consistent with those that would be taught at home.
Right. But you bring up a good point, because we're living in a time of social engineering, and that social engineering is coming from the state. And the state is basically... And that's
and not only the state. You see, you can't go into a grocery store without, knowing that objects have been placed in certain places to make sure that you go buy them, and you're more likely to buy them than if they were not so placed.
Right, and that lends to what they now are identifying as the deep state or the dark state, where because they point to the intelligence communities and these mind or thought think tanks that are trying to form policies and form programs to get us to behave better. It's almost like, and I've talked about this on my show before, about Thanksgiving and about how we've been manipulated with Christmas. And, when they started the mass manipulation of Christmas here in this nation, and what we end up have today is, nothing from any heritage, that I'm going, well, this is just the power, and they understand the power of manipulation.
Sure.
And so with the fact that we do have this state in control of education, more and more people are recognizing that they're not going to want to let go. And the more they get down this path, they're not going to want to lose this power even more and more. And so, especially when they're so much closer to their goal.
I think that, there's something of a pendulum here in many of these areas. You see it in the environmental regulation. You see it in education. Maybe you see it in disaster relief of, what is the responsibility of, the locals. I think one of the most heartening things actually about the Hurricane Harvey is to see, and I hope it's not lost in the wash, but to see how many private volunteers came out and said, we may not be able to wait for help from Washington or Austin. We got to rescue people right now.
Sure.
And that, that's sort of the essence of the American way.
Sure. I know that local churches, local community leaders,
yes,
even politicians, because I've seen here in the state of Washington a call to, from the political parties to say, here's how you can help, do this. And so a lot of them are, pointing to the Red Cross. And I know that I know there's other people that say, don't give to the Red Cross because very little of the dollars goes to the real relief and so forth. But sometimes the Red Cross puts that aside and says, okay, we're going to dedicate everything that is contributed in this fund out to the help of the people instead of the infrastructure and so forth.
Right.
And bottom line, it does cost money to create an organization like the Red Cross, because when I served in the Marine Corps, the Red Cross provided an integral service in letting you know that you had a baby born back in the 70s.
Sure.
And, those things, there was no other mechanism for that but the Red Cross. But
right.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think it's the first public-private sort of partnership of its type in the United States.
Right.
And of course, there are many others since then, but it actually had sort of semi-government, probably not status, but authorization when it was created.
Right. Back to your point of the polarization, though, because the establishment is, people are, I think, on the conservative side have left or are leaving and abandoning the conservative establishment and saying, you know what, if you're not focusing back on the Constitution and you're not moving us in that direction, then we're not supporting you anymore. And that's what we're seeing in elections. And you're absolutely right, because there's absolute communists out here now that are saying, we want communism, we're going to revolt, and we've got guns now, and we're going to fight this out to the death. Now, I understand that that's a small outlier group of communists that are willing to go down that path. And then there's, you start moving back towards the center. I would just really hope, and I hate to say this, but sometimes it takes a movement like those crazy nut job communists to actually go out and kill and inflict the type of harm and, casualties to get people to wake up, like a 9/11, and get people to wake up and go, are we really at that brink? We need to start shifting away from that. And it kind of...
I guess the one caution I would give is, I'm also an alumnus of UVA, and, when I saw the demonstrations there on campus, I was asked actually on a TV show a day or two later, there are thousands and thousands of neo-Nazis out there. I don't think so. I mean, maybe there are in the whole country, but, you can get 250 people from any political stripe probably to show up anywhere. And sometimes I think, yes, there's that kind of polarization, but even among, liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, we seem to have developed a system where the personal interactions that they used to have are much weaker than they used to be, and that there's both sides are sort of demonizing one another. And
right.
I wish we could move, we've had other periods in our history, including our Washington, you know, the Adams administration, where this has happened before.
Right.
But I hope we're not permanently stuck there.
But to be clear, the neo-Nazis is a left organization fighting another left organization of Black Lives Matter or whomever, because Nazism is not a individual liberty, individual sovereignty concept.
Absolutely
so,
not. I mean,
so,
yes.
So I have this, I have 2 minutes left, and
okay.
I'd like to basically say, because I know you love the Constitution, you've written a lot about it, and I know we're probably on 99% common ground when it comes to wanting to save and, you know, getting back towards, you know, the framers' intents and so forth.
Sure.
What would it take? Would it take a disaster, or would it literally take the losing of the Constitution for the recognizing of our electorate and the people to finally stand up and say, we absolutely do not want that discarded? Because the state is getting so powerful and so technical that they will be able, when they make that decision that they want to do that, they will have all sorts of things in their favor, unlike back in Washington's day where muskets were equal. What would you think
Right.
it'll take? We got 1 minute left.
Well, I mean, education is, you know, I'm a university professor, so I have to believe in that. I really believe in building community. You know, I believe churches, I believe, you know, social organizations, all of these are critical. You know, I believe it's important, you know, how we raise our families and what values we try to instill there. And I don't care how much control a kid has, how long they're in school. They're going to get their primary message from their parents. And I think, you know, the founders really took the notion of what they call civic republicanism very seriously, that, you know, we were trained, yes, we would look out for our own security, but we would also be trained to look out for the interest of others. And, you know, any groups, you know, the real heroes of our society may be the grandparents who are raising, you know, raising children because their kids are on crack, and, you know, people that are stepping in the gap and, you know, where they are.
Right. So I will just inject this. The difference between everything that you said then and now is leadership. And what we really need is smart, educated leadership to understand those founding principles. Thank you so much for coming on, Doctor. And I will hopefully have you back on, if you're willing to, in the near future. Thank you again. Okay, so you heard the good doctor. You heard not once, or actually you didn't hear him once say that the state stepping in and using their authority and taking back the Constitution is an unconstitutional act or illegal or wrong or what have you. The bottom line is that the states do have this authority. It's inherent within this contract. The contract clearly gave the states the supreme power over what is to be constitutional, what isn't. And even though the states may be culpable, as we've been saying, that the states have allowed this drift and so forth, because they didn't do it per the contract, it is still a violation of the contract. And so at any point in time, the states can say, you know what, there's nothing in the contract, nothing in the Constitution that says that, you know, if we allow you to do this, you can continue to do this forever and ever. And we've finally gotten to a point where we realize that this has been a huge travesty. We've created all of this debt. We've done all of this damage to our society, and it's time to end. The folly's over. And so we are stepping in, and we are asserting our authority and power. It's just that easy, folks. It literally is. All we need is the leadership, as we were ending up this conversation, educated leadership, because the framers didn't have a smart electorate. They were very illiterate as far as the electorate goes, and they didn't understand Aristotle. They were totally dependent on these great noble men and what they did. And they could have easily been given a king or what have you, but that's not what they did. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people wanted a king. A lot of people wanted a real powerful national government. But the framers knew the dangers in setting up a very powerful national government, because it would be all-consuming. It would have been the precursor, and we would have been probably the poster child for communism. That is not what we want, and nor is that what they gave us. What they gave us was a very limited and defined government. And so let me get into this Madison veto. On March 3rd in 1817, Madison was presented with a bill that it was called an act to set apart and pledge certain funds for internal improvements. And what he says, because what this was going to do was it was going to create a Department of Transportation. And so what he says here is the legislative powers vested in Congress. I'm quoting him, and I'm going to be quoting him, and I'll inject like this editorially, but I want to get through this. The legislative powers in Congress are specified and enumerated in the 8th section of the 1st article of the Constitution, and it does not appear that the power proposed to be exercised by the bill is among the enumerated powers, or that it falls by any just interpretation with the power to make laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution those or other powers vested in the Constitution in the government of the United States. So right there, he clearly said that you can't use the necessary and proper because it has to be applied to those enumerated powers, not just because you think it's necessary or proper. The necessary and proper clause is only tied, and you can only use that when it is applied to the enumerated powers. That you have the rights of citizenship and citizens flow back and forth. So it's necessary and proper that you create passports, but not necessary and proper that you create highways, because there's nothing in the enumerated powers of doing this. Going on, the power to regulate commerce. So here's the commerce clause. The power to regulate commerce among the several states cannot include a power to construct roads and canals and to improve the navigation of water courses in order to facilitate, promote, and secure such commerce without a latitude of construction departing from the ordinary import of the terms strengthened by the known inconveniences which doubtless led to the grant of this remedial power to Congress. So in other words, this power of this corrective power of the Commerce Clause did not create a portal. It was only to be a correction between the states when one state was pitting against another. It was not to regulate commerce to the nth degree like we have today. Your toilet can only flush 0.6 liters and that kind of stuff. Anyway, let me go on. To refer the power in question to the clause to provide for the common defense and general welfare. I think they're coming to arrest me. To provide for the common defense. So he's going into the clause of common defense and welfare. Would be contrary to the established and consistent rules of interpretation as rendering the special and careful enumeration of powers which followed the clause nugatory and improper. Such a view of the Constitution would have the effect of giving Congress a general power of legislation instead of the defined and limited one hitherto understood to belong to them. So he's clearly stating that this general welfare clause would have given them this general one instead of a very limited one. That general welfare and defense clause was just one of, just like in the preamble, it was one that says that all the things that we need to do within these enumerated powers has to be for the benefit of the general welfare, not for creating entitlements and welfare and dependency, because those are all nefarious. Never intended to do that. The terms common defense and general welfare, embracing every object and act within the purview of legislative trust, it would have the effect of subjecting both the Constitution and the laws of the several states in all cases not specifically exempted to be superseded by the laws of Congress. It has been expressly declared that the Constitution of the United States and laws made in pursuance thereof, in other words, laws that are in harmony thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges of every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Now he goes on, because he's just quoted the Constitution there, and now he goes on and says, such a view of the Constitution finally would have the effect of excluding the judicial authority of the United States from its particular or from its participation in guarding the boundary between the legislative powers of the general and state governments, inasmuch as questions relating to the general welfare being questions of policy, expediency, and unsusceptible of judicial organization and cognizance and decision. A restriction of the power to provide for the common defense and general welfare to cases which are to be provided for by the expenditure of money would still leave the legislative power, of Congress, all the great and most important measures of government, money being the ordinary and necessary means of carrying them into execution. If a general power to construct roads and canals and to improve the navigation of watercourses with the train of powers incident thereto be not possessed by Congress, the assent of the states in the mode provided in the bill cannot confer the power. The only cases in which the consent and secession of the particular states can extend the power of Congress are those specified. So he's saying that the only way they could really do this with the actual proper assent from the states is by the Article 5 process within the Constitution. So he goes on and finally says, I am not aware of the great importance. I'll say this again. I am not unaware of the great importance of roads and canals and the improved navigation of watercourses, and that a power in the national legislature to provide for them might be exercised with signal advantage to the general prosperity. But seeing that such a power is not expressly given by the Constitution, and believing that it cannot be deduced from any part of it without an inadmissible latitude of construction and reliance on insufficient precedents, believing also that the permanent success of the Constitution depends on a definite partition of powers between the general and the state governments, and that no adequate landmarks would be left by the constructive extension of the powers of Congress be proposed in the bill, I have no option but to withhold my signature from it and to cherishing the hope that its beneficial objects may be attained by a resort of the necessary powers to the same wisdom and virtue in the nation which established the Constitution in its actual form and providently marked out in the instrument itself and practical mode of improving it as experience might suggest. What he just said here is, I'm not going to sign this, and I hope that we can do this if you would just present this to the states as an amendment. Let the states delegate this power to us the way it's supposed to be done. We cannot usurp this, because if we do, then we will continue to take more and more, and we were going to blur the lines of the power between the states and the general government. This is what I've been saying, folks. And so if you go out and read this, Madison's veto, and it was in 1817, March 3rd, you'll get the same feeling. Well, we're done with this show, as you can tell. Please join us next week, and we will have Ward Connerly with us next week. Thank you so much, and have a blessed weekend.